Former archivist from Akron, Ohio.
Oh.
Former archivist from the Akron Intergroup.
Thank you. That's a great story.
Have fun.
Don't trip on my... I feel like I'm at the rodeo here a little bit. There we go. This will be good. Well, I don't need this microphone. Hi, everybody. My name is Gail, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to start out by asking you to tell you we only have one screen. This screen will not be lit. I'm a little codependent, and I'm worried about some of you on this side of the room not being able to see. It's interactive, and if we can conjure up enough mojo, we might just get bring Bill Wilson back from the dead, and I wouldn't want you to miss that. So if any of you are willing to, I would suggest that you kind of move over and join this side of the room where your perspective might be better for this interaction. And those of you that are antisocial will just stay where you are. But I will be taking attendance and talking to sponsors. And I'll be speaking kind of over here too. So, come on. It's like herding cats, isn't it? Well, while we're waiting for the cats, look, I'm already tangled up. Wow, to be at this state line, I forgot how warm and wonderful it is. Not only is it an honor to be on a program with so many outstanding message givers of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, that's almost surreal to me. But I must say that it is an honor to be with all of you. It's a very special gathering here of people. You can feel the spirit in this room. So I want to start out by thanking you for your sobriety. To be with you in events like this, to me, is like heaven on earth. Just a little piece of heaven on earth. And I'm grateful. Last night, I had an opportunity to share a little bit of my story. But I get even a greater gift tonight. I get to tell our story. This is our story, a collective story of what it was like, what happened, and what it's like, you know, with the writing of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe the true author of the story is God. And Lee has brought all these great pictures that you're going to meet some of these people tonight, if you don't already know them, in this story. And many of them are friends of Alcoholics Anonymous. They're not alcoholics. Many of them are just friends that were links in this chain of events called Alcoholics Anonymous. So I want to start out. This is the Woodstock of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was going to dress up in my bell bottoms, but instead I brought this picture. I don't have time to qualify. The Grapevine would really like to do this for a centerfold for Christmas, but I told him no. if you notice, this is typical me. A half a gallon of wine on one side, a cigarette in the other, a deck of cards, and my zipper's down. And just look at my face. That's on May 13th of 1978. I found my way into the wonderful program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is another photo of me. This is me in a blackout. The way I got involved in, always loved the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. I happened to get sober in Akron, Ohio, and loved AA, and later found out, we didn't have too many history books out, but I found out, oh my God, much of our story took place in my hometown. And we have something called Founders Day, and Lois and would come back. Bill had already passed, and Lois would come back to Founders Day every year, and she would bring some companions. And I mentioned last night when I spoke that I always say yes. That's one thing the old-timers told me. Always, if AA asks you to do something, always say yes. And I had said yes to being a hostess at Founders Day, and that entailed, what are we going to do with Lois and her companions? And I seated Lois and Barry up on the front, and I was seating a beautiful woman by the name of Nell Wing. And she was real easy to get to know. She was a wonderful woman, and she was started to tell me about who she was, actually. She said, you know, I was Bill Wilson's secretary, and I worked with him on the writing of the 12 and 12. And, you know, if I was a cartoon character, you know how people's eyes kind of come out, and then they pop back in their head, you know? I was like, oh, my God. And there happened to be an empty seat, and I sat down next to her, and she told me she would get an autographed book for me because the book Lois Remembers had just come out. And I said, oh, Nell, thank you. If there's anything I could do for you, just ask. Don't ever say that in Alcoholics Anonymous unless you're really willing to go to any lengths. She said, Gail, yes, there is. I'd like you to start an archives. Now, I didn't know what one was. I thought it might be some smelly old papers in Washington. I wasn't sure. But I did try to do what she asked. By the way, my last name in French means the cross. And my mother was going to name me Carrie. When I got this assignment, I felt like I was carrying the cross because we had nothing at that time. And so I, by the way, that's Nell there. She was a true friend of Alcoholics Anonymous. She was a companion to Bill and later to Lois. In fact, if you were to visit Stepping Stone, she had her own room there. She was like a Wilson. And so I did get involved in the purchase of Dr. Bob's home and held it in my name, and then it rolled over into Foundation. And I thought, now I have a place to put this archives. So I flew out and stayed with Nell. I can't believe how wonderful that was. And she took me out to visit Lois Wilson so that I could tell the difference between what belongs to Alcoholics Anonymous, belonged in the General Service Office, Bill's work for us. But personally, what belonged to him belonged at the house. And so I learned a lot. In fact, she told me I couldn't be an archivist at Dr. Bob's house if I wanted to be an AA archivist because AA can't own property. And I spent the next 3 days trying to talk her out of our traditions. Here I am having a drink with Lois. That is me in that picture. I was sober in that picture. However, my hair hadn't sobered up yet. I'm still powerless over it. It's a bit unmanageable. So I'd like to take you on a quick field trip. I know some of you are going to get that sugar buzz, and about halfway through my talk, you're going to start nodding out. But I'm going to get this part in. Just want you to know that in Akron, there's a lot for you to see, and I wouldn't want you to miss the archives that I later got involved in at our intergroup office. Some of you may have seen the stained glass window. It's one of the first things you'll see in what we call our flying blind room. It's framed with the four absolutes. And those are all sobriety coins. And while we were doing this, there's 1,000 pieces of glass in there. And if you had come in to visit, we would have asked you to, if you wanted to cut a piece of glass and become a part of that window, or you could have thrown in your sobriety coin and you'd have helped us frame it because it's men and women who normally would not mix. And then you'll go down a long hallway where the big books written in the many different languages, about 55, are there. And there's flags right above them. And then the big books are in the cases, and we get so many visitors now from different countries that they sign the big books from their country, and those books are all now becoming archival, as well as a poster that you might see there from the first AAs in Russia. It was presented long before we actually had the archives. When I would be standing at Founders Day, a woman gave it to me from France, and she said the groups was given to us from the first AAs in Russia. It's signed, and the people of France would like Akron to have it. So you'd see that there. Along with the tartans, do you know that they have recovery tartans? They took the Smith clan and the Wilson clan, and they took the plaids and they made tartans, and they're commissioned. And then there's 26 displays, and we have like a headset you can put on, and you can travel through if one of us is not there to take you through, and we'll walk you through the beautiful story of the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous. And after you go there, you'd actually go into, that's an art gallery that's got some different things in it. And you know what? I need to back that up. Something happened here. Oh. Just want to back it up. It's not going to work. I was going to take you into the interior. It doesn't want to go. But we have Sister Ignatius' rosary, Dr. Bob's manuscript copy of the book, some letters from Hank Parkhurst, lots of wonderful things to see. And then we also have a lab because paper dies, and we want it to be around for as long as we can. So we're trying to clean it, preserve it, deacidify it, and keep it for future generations. And if you want to visit the website there, the voices from Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers are MP3 files. You're welcome to download them and listen to them. We're also trying to keep those voices alive. Okay, now for what we came for. This took me about 6 weeks in PowerPoint to learn how to do that front slide. I've advanced since then. Some of you have tried some of these programs. This is just sort of set the stage here of Akron, early Akron. And we were a rubber capital of the world. We weren't known, now we're known as the birthplace of Alcoholics Anonymous. But at the time, we were the rubber capital of the world. And we had some families there that were like royalty. One of the families was the Firestones. And Mr. Firestone had several sons. One of those sons, named Russell, was a terrible alcoholic. And I like to say all the king's horses and all the king's men could not put that kid back together again. Money won't buy sobriety. If Mr. Firestone could have bought that son's sobriety, he would have. They sent him away to treatment. They did all that they could. And then there was an intervention of sorts. This guy on the left, his name's Jim Newton. He's one of my favorite people in our story. You may not have heard of him. A lot of people don't know this part of the story. God can use womanizers. He was a young luggage salesman. He's in Massachusetts, and he's chasing pretty girls. And he thinks he's on a way to the singles dance. And he follows them right in, and he ends up at an Oxford group meeting. And he becomes a great Oxford group member. In fact, he's down in Fort Myers, Florida, and he's working for Thomas Edison. Almost was like a son to Thomas Edison developing real estate. Well, Harvey Firestone was good friends with Thomas Edison, and he's visiting, and he takes a liking to Jim Newton. I mean, really, these are such slender threads. And he brings him to Akron. And he becomes friends with Russell, or Bud, who's in this picture here on the right. Now, this is so codependent, and this is so... He goes away to treatment with him, trying to help him. Even, you know, jogs with him, does all that stuff. But the kid just can't stay sober, and the family gives up hope. Well, Jim talks about, why don't you come with me to Denver where the Oxford group is meeting? They traveled by train in those days, and he agreed to go. And there was a flask of alcohol. There was some controlled drinking. He turned the bottle over to Jim, and they just did the controlled drinking the whole way there. But on the way coming back, another slender thread... Sam Shoemaker was on the train. Some of you may know who Sam Shoemaker is. He pulled into a train car, and in those days it was called soul surgery, and he got down on his knees, and he surrendered. Now, when he gets off the train in Akron, he's not the same guy. He doesn't look the same. The lines on his forehead were gone. He's no longer beating the wife. And the father... is so grateful. If you think of the prodigal son story, what does the father do when the son returns home? The father throws a big dinner. That's what Mr. Firestone did. This is the founder of the Oxford group, Frank Buchman. How do you like that? Somebody in here would correct me right now if I didn't say Buchman. And a lot of press. This is a big deal. The Firestones are throwing this party. They are royalty, and Akron is very intrigued by this. They're going to get next to it, and they're going to hold this at the, you can see, by the way, this was a very high social affair. All of our society came out for it, and they were quite dressed up. That's Harvey Firestone there on your left. And they're going to hold it at the newly opened Mayflower Hotel. This is Depression times, but they had set aside money for the opening of this hotel, and it's a year and a half old in January of 33, and they're going to hold a dinner, and there's about 400 at that dinner, and Bud Firestone is going to give testimony to his recovery from alcoholism. That's really important, because when we get to talking a little bit about what happens in New York, there's going to be a difference in how drunks are received in both cities. But because Oxford Group's coming to town for this drunk's recovery, it makes a difference. At this time, Henrietta's going to get involved, and Ann Smith, because they're going to hold house parties. And they're going to hold them in the morning and at night for the next 10 days. They're going to keep them in Akron. They're going to go out into the pulpits of the churches. And I always believe in looking back at this as if the soil is being prepared. At this time, Dr. Bob will get involved, and for the next little over 2 years, he's going to do everything that the Oxford Group says. He really liked the Oxford Group. His disease had progressed. He was kind of getting down and out. He didn't have too many friends. And he walked into a room like this. And I imagine that the Oxford group had a similar spirit. He saw the laughter. He saw the sharing. He heard all that. He was very attracted to it. And for a man that never said he was never going to set foot in a church again, he did all that. He went back to church. He read the Bible. And the Oxford group were prolific readers. And he was reading all the time. And he did everything. But he couldn't get sober. I think that's really important because they had most of the principles that we have today in our 12-step program. And here's a man that's doing everything, but there was one thing missing. So Henrietta is here, and she gets a call from a woman by the name of Delphine Weber. And Delphine Weber says, what are we going to do about Dr. Bob? And she says, what do you mean, what are we going to do about Dr. Bob? She said, well, he's got a terrible drinking problem. You know, his business, his practice is about gone, and they're about ready to lose their home. And they don't ever share at Oxford group meetings. So I picture in this picture here of Henrietta. She's in her quiet time because the Oxford group took morning watches. They called it guidance. They'd get up in the morning. They would read from a devotional, usually the Bible. Then they had this part for listening, and they'd have a pencil and a paper, and they would write down what they thought God's guidance was for them that day. Then there was another real important part. It was called checking. And you would call somebody up, much like maybe we would a sponsor today, and they would check your guidance to see where that was coming from, and they'd run it by the four absolutes, which I'll tell you about in just a minute, to check to see if that guidance was really coming from God. Henrietta's going to get guidance. And the thing about her guidance is, it has to do with an intervention on Bob and Ann. You can go home and turn on your TVs and learn about intervention. There's programs now on TV. Back in 1935, I don't even think they used the word. They might not have even called what her guidance was intervention. But she gets guidance to call her friends T. Henry and Clarice Williams. They lived in this beautiful Tudor home. He was a tire mold inventor, and he worked for National Rubber Machinery Shop. National Rubber Machinery Shop, you know, Bill's coming to Akron to take over at a proxy fight, that particular company. He's going to lose his job because of Bill Wilson. He's ready to lose his home because of the Depression. They were foreclosing on homes, much like they're doing in right now. And the bank stopped just short of taking this home because they couldn't take any more homes. So this was, to them, God's house. And they said, can we use your house for a special meeting? We'd like to do a special meeting for Dr. Bob and Ann. Now, they held the planning meeting on a Monday because they had what they called a setup meeting. And you had a leader, and it was Henrietta, and she said, we're going to share, and we're going to share deeply, and there's not going to be any pussyfooting around. Now, on Wednesday, though, at 8 o'clock is when they had the meeting. And they all went around the room, and we didn't have tapes back then, so we don't know what they said. I have no idea what those high society had to say. What, they put their hand on the stove and said a four-letter word? I don't know. But they went around the room and they shared. And when it came Dr. Bob's turn, he looked up at him and there was this long pause and he thanked him. And he said, now at the cost of my profession, I am a secret drinker and I cannot stop. And they said, Bob, would you like us to pray for you? And he said, yes. And they're going to get down on their knees in this living room and pray for Bob. I think about 2 weeks after that, Bill Wilson's going to come to town. And of course, you know that call's going to go from the Mayflower Hotel to Henrietta Seiberling, who's living in this little gate lodge here. And I moved Carl Jung away because it was bothering me last night that Jung and Bob were hooking up because I thought maybe Henrietta was a better match here. So, now, Bob and Bill knew that they had to work with another alcoholic to stay sober, and they weren't sure what they had. They certainly didn't call it Alcoholics Anonymous. Dr. Bob worked at City Hospital at that time, so he called up a nurse, and he said they were looking for somebody, and they had a cure for alcoholism, and the nurse said, well, Bob, have you tried it on yourself? And they had this guy strapped down to the bed. And they make this 12-step call on Bill D. And on July 4th of 1935, he's going to walk out of the hospital a free man and never drink again. And in your big books, it said that's when group number one begins. But I don't know how many of you know that July 4th. So the next time you see fire in the sky, you might have a little prayer of thanksgiving for our own independence, huh? They wouldn't have taken him the big book. They would have taken him four words. Dr. Bob says that those were the only yardsticks we had. That's what we measured our behavior by. And if you come to the Akron-Cleveland area and attend meetings, we are still studying those words. Those words are still passed down to us from our elder statesmen. And there's four questions that go with those four words of honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love. Is what I'm about to think, say, or do right or wrong? True or false? Ugly or beautiful? And how does it affect the other guy? They will continue to meet at this house Wednesday at 8 o'clock. You know the night the prayer was said? Wednesday at 8 o'clock. This house right here, Wednesday at 8 o'clock, will become the main meeting place of the group. It will be called, well, it's called the Alcoholic Squad initially. They don't have a name, but they call it the Alcoholic Squad. And it grows in here, only we can't sit still for the guidance. So we're jonesing all the time, so we just don't want to go and sit there and listen for God's voice. So Bob would take them into the upper room here, and he would get the surrenders, and then they would come back down. And we pretty much filled up this house, and we just outgrew them. And the reason for that is, for us, it's life and death. It wasn't just a social event for us. If that's the mother group, I just want you to realize that I believe that all groups come from this group. And so you can trace your home group back to the prayer that was said in that living room. The other stage we're only going to have two groups for quite a while. There'll be the group that starts in Akron. Bill hadn't been able to get anybody sober. Before he had come to Akron, he had filled his house with alcoholics. Not one had gotten sober. But he learned, thank God, before he came to Akron, that if you work with another alcoholic, you can stay sober. And he's going to return. Now, you know, this is Calvary Church. This would be the headquarters of the Oxford group, and Sam Shoemaker is the head of that church. They'll have meetings there that Bill and Lois will attend. And here's Calvary House, where they went. And let's go inside and see what one of their meetings would look like. This is an actual photo of an Oxford group meeting attended by Bill and Lois. So it looks like it's a Thursday night meeting here. But what's going to happen is, you know, Bill has that spiritual experience, and all he wants to do is work with another drunk. He really doesn't want to be all things to all people. And what he will do is he will come back to the Oxford group, but he'll about knock you down looking for a drunk. And after a while, that kind of got on the Oxford group's nerves, and they kind of gave Bill and Lois the cold shoulder. So by 1937, this is an artist's rendition here, they will start to meet at Clinton Street. And they'll form a group, and that'll be called the Drunk Squad, or a nameless bunch of drunks. Now, Bill is one minute he's a millionaire, the next minute he's broke. You know, he's just up and down. Bipolar for sure, venture here, I don't know. But he's trying to make a comeback. He's got a business trip. He's coming back to Akron. He's going to stop in. He's going to stop in and see his good friends by now. He had spent the summer with us in 35. And he's going to stop in and see Bob and Ann. There'd been a lot of failures. This thing didn't take off real quick. A lot of people came in, but they didn't stick around. Even Evie goes back out. And they're sitting around in the living room at 855 Ardmore. And I know I photoshopped Bill in. I can see you can tell that. But I needed a picture of all three of them. And the date should be 1937. They start counting up how many people are sober. And this is a big turning point here. They did not know what they had, and they count up, and by God, 40 people had stayed sober. Some of them even had more than a year. And for some reason, at that moment, they realized they were onto something, that a light had come into the dark world of the alcoholic. And all three of them wept. And then they bowed their heads in prayer and thanksgiving. Now, if you know anything about Bill Wilson, that didn't last too long. The next thought, right after that, was we need a chain of hospitals. He'd been working on Wall Street, and he knew about those chain of drugstores, so we need a chain of hospitals. We need some missionaries, and we better get together on writing that book so that the message doesn't get garbled. Now, Bob, he was a little more cautious about things like that, and they had discovered this thing called a group conscience. Maybe we ought to take it to the group and see what the group has to say. Very early move on a group conscience level. And one of the beautiful things about this friendship that these two men had does not mean that they always agreed. But they agreed to disagree agreeably. Now, Dr. Bob's son, Smitty, would say, if it was up to Bob, AA would have never left Akron. If it was up to Bill, he'd have franchised it. And I want you to just kind of capture the two of them here. There's no sound to this. But aren't they adorable? Check out Bob's tie. And you can tell there's that spirit of humor, and you can see that they're free men, that they're... You can just see the sense of humor they both had. And I don't know what they're saying. Bob's probably telling Bill to keep it simple. And, there you can check out the tie there. And he'd wear Argyle socks. And in just a minute, you're going to see Ann Smith. Bill would call her the mother of AA, and she truly was. There she is. Now, she was sort of shy and didn't like this camera business at all. And she can just say, oh, come on, I just want to stay in the background. We need a signer here to tell us what they're saying, don't you think? All right. So what they're going to do is they're going to go back to this flying... By the way, they called this the flying blind period. Because we didn't have any conference-approved literature, guys, okay? We were using Oxford Group literature. We were flying blind because we didn't know what was going on. So they go back to this house, and they're going to put this thing to a vote. And this is kind of how it went. This is the living room where they attended it. And Bill's going to pitch it, being the salesman that he was. And this is what he's going to say. He's going to say, we need a chain of hospitals. We need some paid missionaries. And, you know, we need some literature to keep this message from getting garbled. And the people from Akron and Squad are going to say, the man of Galilee had no press agents, newspapers, pamphlets, or books. Keep it simple. Bill said, you can keep it so simple, you'll have anarchy. He said, don't you know there's alcoholics that are dying within gunshot of this house? So they did vote on it. And I believe there was... either 18 or 19 men. And by just one vote, they're going to send Bill back. And they said, wow, if it's going to take money, you can go back to New York and raise that money. So Bill's going to go back to the Big Apple, and he's going to put a pitch to the rich. And he and his buddy Hank, they're going to go around. They're going to try to get some money, but they're not very successful. People say, what's a big deal about 40 drunks sober? We'd rather give to the Red Cross or the Salvation Army. Well, Bill was subject to some of those depressions and what he called imaginary ulcers. And his sister, Dorothy, had married a doctor, Leonard Strong. Thank God. This guy's going to play a big part in this story, I'll tell you that much. So Bill goes off, and he's going to go off and see Leonard. And he's going to start whining to Leonard about how nobody's giving him any money and the rich and everything. And you know what the difference between an alcoholic that's whining and a dog that's whining is, don't you? Well, the dog will stop whining when you let him in. So he's pitching to Leonard, and he's saying to Leonard, you know, this. And Leonard says, you know, I knew a girl in high school whose father... worked with the Rockefellers. And so he puts in a phone call, and then there's a letter of introduction, and the guy is Reverend Willard Richardson, Rockefeller's best friend and spiritual advisor. Couldn't have picked a more perfect guy. And the next thing you know, Bill's on his way shortly after that to visit with him. And he goes from ulcer to the 54th floor of the Rockefeller building. And this is when he says, on what slender threads our destiny does lie. He's going to meet with him, and Willard likes the idea and is going to introduce him to more Rockefeller people at a special meeting in December of that year. And Bill is going to meet in the boardroom, Rockefeller's boardroom, and he sat down in a chair that Rockefeller had just vacated, and he said, boy, he thought he was getting close to that money. That's what they wanted. And they were all kind of sitting around, and they really didn't know what to say. I mean, what do a bunch of drunks say at something like that? And they looked at each other, and they said, why don't we just tell our stories? And that's what they did. And as they started going around the room telling their story, Albert Scott says, wait a minute. This sounds like first century Christianity, which is kind of interesting because that was once the name of the Oxford group. Well, let's see who was there. There was Albert Scott, Willard Richardson, Leonard Strong, Dr. Silkworth was there, Frank Amos was there, and Leroy Chipman, Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob, Hank P., Fitz M., Ned P., and Dick Stanley. The next statement is, gentlemen, up to this point, this has been the work of goodwill only, no plan, no property, no paid people, just one carrying the good news to the next. Isn't that true? And may it not be that this is where the great power of this society lies? Now, Frank Amos was from Ohio, and I believe it was on his own dime he came to check us out. And what he found out, that Dr. Bob was a pretty good doctor now that he was sober. So that might not be a bad place to put a hospital and put Dr. Bob in charge. He recommended, now I have to tell you this, but I think Bill might not be accurate on this. He's been known to prefabricate our history a little bit. I just read a book coming in on the plane. And in there, and I believe it's true because a friend of mine just wrote a book on the Rockefellers, I don't believe it's 50,000. I think the recommendation was 10,000, and I think Rockefeller ended up giving us 5. But the way Bill tells it is, it was 50. And they're going to use it to help buy down Dr. Bob's house so he didn't lose it. He was close to losing it. He was putting all his time and work into drunks, as you know. They're going to get a rehabilitation place and put him in charge, subsidize a few people, start those hospitals, and get busy on the book. By the time it gets across the desk from Richardson to Rockefeller, Rockefeller's whole reaction to this is very interesting. He said, somehow I'm strangely stirred by all this. This interests me immensely. But isn't money going to ruin this thing? I think it's interesting that he gets strangely stirred. He says, I want to hear what goes on, but please don't bother me for any more money. No, I won't be the one to spoil this thing with money. Now, the rest of them, Richardson, Amos, all the rest of them, they don't go with him. It's only Rockefeller that says that. What they do is, I'll show you this, that 50, pretend that's not 50 anymore since I got that new information. Get shrunk down to 5. They use the money to pay off the house or pay down the house. And the house only costs $4,000 to start with. That leaves the guys $2,000. And they're going to put it in Rockefeller's church here. And they're going to draw $20 to $30 a week from that. Of course, that was worth a lot more back in the 1930s. Harry Emerson Fosdick is the head of the church. He will write the first big book review that will appear in the New York Times. They're going to get a young attorney from the Rockefeller side, and his name is John Wood. And they're going to draft our charter. And here's the big question. They're going to call it the Alcoholic Foundation. They have to know, what is the difference between an alcoholic and a non-alcoholic? You think that's where we got that from? I don't know. Some of you got that, and it's late, and you've had ice cream. All right. And so they decided that an alcoholic is somebody who can't drink, and non-alcoholic is somebody who can. They put Leonard Strong in as the secretary, Richardson, Leroy Chipman will be treasurer, Frank Amos, Dr. Bob will be on there, Bill R. will get drunk, and there'll be Harry B. Bill will be on an advisory committee and sitting on the sidelines. They've got a little office at this time. Actually, they started a car products business, and that's Hank, Bill's partner, and Bill. And they're going to hire this little secretary by the name of Ruth Hawk. There's a picture right down, the same picture is right below here. That's the table that Bill and Ebby will meet at. If you get a chance to visit Stepping Stones, you can actually sit at that table. But they're sitting at the table, and it's in Pass It On, and underneath it, it says, Ruth never knew what she was getting herself into. And the reason for that, and she'll tell you this herself in some of her sound bites, she says, she thought she was going to be the secretary for the car products, but she said, I never saw any car products being sold. She said it was either somebody passed out in a chair or down on their knees making a surrender. And this is a part of the office there. The little circle is where the office was. And, you know, we have word processing today, but can you imagine the typing of that book as Bill would pace around beside her? And this is Hank. Now, he could have an idea a minute. He was quite the promoter as well. It was his idea to write the book, and he will write the outline for the book. And there's another picture of Ruth. She's going to get the 5 millionth copy of the big book in Montreal. And there's her typewriter that's at an office. Now, we couldn't afford to pay her. We're going to have those stock certificates, but they're worthless. They're supposed to be worth $25, but, you know, they're just ripping her off one. I mean, we're not incorporated or anything. They're just ripping her off one of these a week as her weekly ration. And when I got to give this talk for the first time in Toronto at our international, my roommate was Ruth Hawk's daughter. And I got to say there, because she was with us then, I said, little did Ruth know that the book she was typing would one day save her daughter's life. And Lori stood up with about 30 years of sobriety. That was pretty moving. Now, some of the ideas for the big book were told by some of our historians had come from some other people. William James contributed in his book, Varieties of Religious Experiences. And we have this book here. This is the Oxford Group textbook. It's called What is the Oxford Group? And I just need to tell you a cute little story. You're going to like this. I've loved AA. I've loved the history. And you know how we all are when we come into AA. We just start collecting those books, don't we? The Gate Lodge sits on the Cyberling Estate. It's called Stan Hewitt. They have harvest festivals there, and I was attending one of them. And they had a book bin right behind the Gate Lodge. And I went to it, and I said, do you have any old AA books? This is 1983. They said, no. I said, well, do you have any spiritual books? And they said, yes. And my hand went to this little thin blue book, and I pulled it out, and it said, what is the Oxford Group? And I thought, were we the movement or the group? I wasn't sure. But when I opened it up, the book said, R.H. Smith, 855 Ardmore, his book, Please Return. Maybe I should say that the book found me. Now, I did try to get him down to a quarter. I'm bargain addicted. I had to pay 35 cents for that book. I did return it. You'll see it at Dr. Bob's house. Common Sense of Drinking by Richard Peabody was a favorite. Of course, most of you know about Sermon on the Mount by Emmett Fox. Still a great book for us. Some Oxford groups, especially for sinners only, by A.J. Russell. And just because a friend of mine's here that loves Vic Kitchen, I Was a Pagan was also a really popular book. And I don't know why it's doing that. I haven't a clue. Let's see. Why would it do that? I have an idea why it did that, but I don't think I like it. I think there's, you know what it is? okay, we're going to do this because this thing wants attention. There we go. Now let's get back here. No, this doesn't want to get back. There we go. All right, sorry about that. Okay. All right. Okay, so we're going to talk another contributor. I think Ebby had a lot to do with it because Ebby brings Bill the most perfect 12-step call. And in that 12-step call, when Bill writes his biography, you can see many of our steps just in the message that Ebby carried to Bill. Because Bill's going to write his biography before he writes the 12 steps in the fifth chapter, How It Works. He's also going to write, along with his biography, There Is a Solution and a little bit of an introduction to the book. And then he's going to ask Ann Smith if she'll write a chapter to the wives. And Ann just wanted to stay in the background, so she declined. Lois got a bit of a resentment about that. And most of you know who wrote chapter to the wives, don't you? Bill. That is funny. Today, that's funny. Now, through another series of slender threads, Bill's going to get a tip to go see the religious editor from Harper's Magazine, Eugene Exman. And he's going to take those three pieces to Eugene, and Eugene's going to look at them. And now, Bill wasn't a writer. You know, isn't it amazing what he did at just so few years of sobriety? Anyway, Eugene said, Bill, this is pretty good. He says, can you do anything else like this? Bill goes, oh, yeah, I can. He said, well, I'd like to give you a $1,500 advance on this book. Please remember, this is depression times. The Wilsons were hungry, and that Bill was pretty excited about that. Wait a minute, what's going on here? I hope it isn't acting crazy again. Oh, Bill Wilson! Ladies and gentlemen, Bill, I got to tell you this. I'm in Vegas this time. I'm at something called the State Line Retreat. I think you'd like it a lot because it's in your honor. They hold it every year in honor of your sobriety. And so we're real glad you showed up because why should I tell you the story if Bill's here? So, Bill, would you be willing to share with us a little bit tonight on the writing of the big book?
Now then.
Oh, yes. Okay.
As a graphic illustration of how pain and fear and all of our worst motives can eventuate under God's grace for the best, I would like to, in a hop, skip, and jump fashion, tell you about the preparation of the AA book.
Well, I was telling him a little bit about Eugene Exman and how he offered you all that money. So, what happened to that deal? Did you take him up on that offer?
A few of us stood for the proposition, well, this would be bad because control of our literature would be in other hands. And some of us, in a more self-serving way, and this definitely included me, we felt that the book might make some profits and some royalties out of which its creators could eat.
Yeah, I knew you were pretty hungry. Well, if you're going to produce a book, how are you going to get the monies for that?
Some of us in New York considered the possibility of publishing this book ourselves.
And how would you do that?
So then we went up to the Reader's Digest and told them about our budding movement, and I guess we brandished Mr. Rockefeller's name pretty liberally, you know, as a close friend. He wasn't giving us any money, but he liked us.
Well, did they go for that pitch?
The Digest said, well, fine. When will your book come out? By now, it's the fall of 38. Oh, we said about next spring. They said, this is just the kind of story that we'd like. We will do a piece. We'll put a feature writer on this.
Well, you know, Bill, they're going to put a feature writer on it, but, you know, you're not a writer. So didn't you have some fears about writing the book yourself? What were they?
Who would publish such a book? Who could assemble such a book? What should go in it? Supposing it turned out badly. These, indeed, for us, were great and most natural fears.
Well, did you come up with a plan?
And then a plan came into being. It was thought there ought to be a text. It was thought these ought to be backed up by stories. And this text was, in the first edition, 2/3 of the stories came from Akron.
Yes. Well, there we have the part of the notes on the chapters written by Hank. And but you needed to come up with a way to get that money. So what did you do?
So down east, we began to peddle stock in what turned out to be the AA book. But we were peddling stock to drunks, $25 a share. The purpose was what? To feed Wilson and the gal who helped do the book and the promoter and the collector of the money.
I see. Well, you know, Bill, on the certificate up there, it says Works Publishing. Can you tell us why you called it Works?
The title was chosen because there would be a lot more work, you know, after this.
And then you wrote this prospectus. Tell us a little bit about the prospectus.
So in the prospectus, we totted up what the profits would be. Oh, I think we started in with something like 100,000 books.
Wow.
The first few carloads. And I think we got as high as 1 million copies. Well, of course, if they only cost 35 cents and you sold them for $3.50, it would be, frankly, a great rise in that $25 stock. Might go to $1,000 a share.
Wow.
We didn't put all this on paper, but it was a part of the promotion.
So you have a lot of takers in our audience tonight. How did you pitch it to the groups?
We would sell these 35-cent books for the sum of $3.50. We didn't indicate any other expenses, but that seemed quite a margin of profit to the prospective stock buyer. And we pointed out that they couldn't possibly miss, because, after all, the digest piece with millions of circulation, in which they definitely would mention the new book, would simply move these volumes out in carloads.
Whoa.
While this job was being done. In other words, people were asked to buy stock in a book that hadn't yet been written. I think this is a world's record for sheer audacity.
Jeez. Well, what did people think when they heard about this idea, Bill?
Well, this was heard out in this country. That this ex-Wall Street swindler was contriving one of the greatest rackets known to the mind man.
And then what was their reaction to that?
Well, when this motivation began to be suspected and became apparent, quite a violent opposition rose up.
What'd you do?
So then, we had only begun our troubles.
Really?
Then the book had to be written.
Well, did you start writing it then?
Well, I wrote another sample chapter and tried that on them. No stock purchases.
Jeez. Well, what about the trustees? They were probably getting pretty tired of that by now. What did they have to say?
And the trustees were very dubious. They had no money at the time, so we were able to face them down and say, well, we'll separately incorporate this. And sure enough, by an appeal to the loyalty of the stockholders to the cause, but also by an appeal to the pocketbook, the baser nature, the money began to dribble in. $25 per bet.
Wow. Oh, now you could get started on the book.
However, we were eating, a few of us, on the stockholders' money. And little by little, the chapters were evolved. And we thrashed them around in the AA meetings, and we carefully checked them with Dr. Bob as they went along. And meanwhile, he, at great pains and difficulty, got stories, largely from this town.
Yeah, and they used to meet around that table. None of them were writers. That was really difficult for them to write those stories. Thank God Jim Scott got sober, and he was an editor, and he helped him out a little bit. And you would pass these chapters back and forth between your group and the group in Akron. And then came the night that you wrote the 12 steps. And we always love to hear about that. Would you tell us a little bit? I know it was a rough night for you. You were depressed. You were really down. Share with us what that was like.
In short, here was AA at its worst. But under God's grace, coming up with something better. Maybe history will say the best. And so the work went on, and I remember one night we got through the first four chapters, which were window dressing, and I was having an imaginary ulcer attack, and it looked like, things were very gloomy. The stockholders were kind of falling down, or the meal ticket was getting in danger, and I was very resentful. And I realized, lying in bed there in Brooklyn Clinton Street, that the book had to say what it was all about at some place. So I began to write, and out came the 12 steps.
Well, we know you had written down the 6 steps, and you just kind of thought that maybe an alcoholic could fall through those cracks. Somebody just said, yeah. Do I hear an amen, you know? Anyway, you expanded them, and you came up with the number 12, and you thought that was a pretty good number. So what'd you do? Then you presented them to the group. What did they have to say?
Well, when they appeared, there was a terrific uproar. And as a result of the uproar, again, the constructive came out. I had had a great spiritual experience, so that I had used God all the way through those 12 steps.
Wow. Well, if you use God all the way through the 12 steps, what did the atheist and agnostics think?
Our atheist and agnostic contingent said, drunks only go buy that. They're scared to death of being God-bitten. This ought to be a psychological book.
Wow. Well, then, what did the religious people say?
On the other hand, the religious people said that it should be a strictly Christian book, theologically speaking. So one had to sort of average these point of views.
And you did that, Bill. You did average those two points of views. In fact, about this point, you didn't even think you were writing the book. You thought you might be umpiring it. And after the debate took place, and I know Jimmy Burwell weighed in, and you came up with the term God as you understand him. And that was considered a 10 strike, and that has made such a difference in Alcoholics Anonymous. It really opened up the doors. Do you think you had God's help?
Sure, we must have had God's help. We never could have produced it ourselves.
Well, could you sum up a little bit for us, the writing of the book?
So this is the unholy way in which God nevertheless graced us in the days when AA was very young.
Well, Bill, that kind of tells us about the writing of the book, but we know there's a whole story in the publication of it.
Well, finally, the great day, our publication approached. We had pre-publication copies of the book made, circulated around for criticism, and with the last of our money, almost the last, we persuaded the printer that this was such a terrific venture that he certainly ought to accept a 10% down payment for 5,000 books, which were going out by the carload, this first installment. So we paid him $500 for 5,000 books.
Wow, what a deal that was, huh? And when they went out, these publications that went out, there was about 400 of them, and you got some feedback from different people, and one of them was that you should put in a doctor's opinion. That was also another brilliant idea. And then some of the markings came back, and it got pretty scratched up, and as they came back, you began to change that document. Some of the input that you got, there was too much Oxfordizing in it. And then they started to say that you need to take out some of the I's and change it to we. And you took the word Y-O-U-R and you crossed off all the yours and made it ours. And I think I've blown this up a little bit. Maybe we can see some of those. One of the pages says, "Thy will be done. We don't rush God." That's a little thing that was on the margin. And this became the working copy of the big book. I don't know if some of you can see the we's in there and the different handwriting. And you can see the edges here. It came out in like a spiral-bound document. And it looks like a lot of you would like to see even more of this. It says, "The one chance to free ourselves of criticism is written here on the side." Invaluable advice, don't you think? And you can see what a mess this document was. Well, when they took it to Cornwall Press, they all had to accompany it because they had to help them typeset it. It was just, they couldn't retype it. And recently, Hazelden has just published a copy of that document. So we all now, and you're welcome to come up. This is a gift to Lee, but Lee said that you can put some love on this book that he's taken it home, but you can come up and check it out. And you'll see that each page in here is photocopied with different colored ink from different authors. And if there's an HP, I think I put one of those up there, had an HP, you'll see Hank's signature as they checked off each one of these. There it is. You can see Hank's signature here on the bottom. Well, we didn't know what to call it. We were going to call our fellowship 100 Men Corporation. Florence Rankin gets sober in the nick of time. She says, "You can't call it 100 men. You got to call it 100 men and one woman." Of course, Bill thought it'd be nice to call it the Bill W. Movement. Nameless bunch of drunks, dry frontiers, empty glass, the way out. And another guy got out of the nut house just in the nick of the time by the name of Joe Warden. And he's sitting in a corner saying, "Anonymous Alcoholics, Anonymous Alcoholics." Then he switches it and he calls it Alcoholics Anonymous. And Bill, tell us a little bit about how we got our name.
We'd been calling ourselves out there a nameless bunch of drunks, and from that the anonymity idea had come in. In fact, the book title, as voted by Akron, New York, and a few Clevelanders, was chosen as The Way Out. But in the Library of Congress, we'd found that there were 12 books by the name of The Way Out. So for heaven's sake, we couldn't make a 13th, so it became Alcoholics Anonymous.
Wow, if Akron would have gotten its way, we'd be the Way Outers today. I can just see the T-shirts now.
Then we went up to the Digest and said, "Now what about this piece? We're all ready to shoot." And the editor whom we had talked vaguely remembered us, and he said, "Shoot what?"
Oh, Bill. Man, that had to be a shock. Well, what'd you tell him?
Well, we reminded our friend that a piece was due, and he said, "Gee, Mr. Wilson," he said, after you were here, I went to the rest of the staff here very sure that this would be a great piece. But they Didn't think so, and I forgot to tell you.
Oh, Bill, that had to be... I mean, you didn't hardly have anybody sober. Nobody knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. That must have been horrible. What was it like?
So we had 5,000 books in the warehouse. There were 100 AA members. There were about 30 stockholders, and they each got a book. There were about 30 guys who put stories in the books, and they each got a book, and that was 60 books. So we only had 40 books to sell the rest if they'd buy it.
Well, and then things kind of got rough for you personally, didn't they?
Well, at that time, things folded up in a big way. We were about to be evicted from our house in Clinton Street. Stuff go into storage. The book was bankrupt, and we made one last great gasp effort.
Wow, Bill, what was that?
A drunk came along by the name of Morgan who had been in the ad business, and he said, you know, I know Gabriel Heater. You know, the guy who puts on those wonderful sob talks. And he said, I think Gabriel would put this on the air. So we scared up a few dollars more. And to get ready for Gabriel, we decided...
God, Bill. Well, what did you do to get ready for Gabriel?
Well, we picked out a hard class of people to advertise to in those days. We picked out all of the physicians east of the Mississippi River, all of them.
Wow.
And to each one, we sent a postal card which said, listen to Gabriel Heater as he talks about the new Society of Alcoholics Anonymous. And buy the book Alcoholics Anonymous, A Cure for Alcoholism.
Well, wasn't there a problem with Morgan?
Well, one great trouble with Ryan was that he wouldn't sober up and he was supposed to be interviewed on the air. My God, our last cent was in this thing and all these postal cards.
God, well, what did you do with Ryan?
So just as a precaution, one of our friends who was a member of the Down Athletic Club said, well, now, you can have my room over there. I don't use it much. And why doesn't somebody live with Morgan in there the week before, you know, to just stay with him and be sure he gets the heater all right?
Wow, that had to be before Al-Anon. Well, how did that plan come off, Bill?
So the great day came. The postal cards was out in Akron, New York, Cleveland. The ears were to the radio. We visioned the books going out in carloads, orders flooding in. Biggest profit of all in direct mail, no commissions. And sure enough, Heater pulled out the tremolo stop. Ryan was sober, and boy, we were made.
Wow. Well?
We gave a post office box, old 458 in New York, I think it was, where we had a one-room office. Little Ruthie Hawk, who helped me with the book, bless her soul, my promoter friend Hank Parkes and I, just couldn't wait to get over to see what was coming into that box.
Oh, I know. Well, didn't you take, like, suitcases with you? Held yourself back for 3 days, took the suitcases, and weren't you, like, a little disappointed when you looked into the glass and you didn't see too many postcards? What was Hank's reaction?
Hank was an incorrigible optimist. He said, well, they couldn't put them all in the box. He said they got several mailbags full out there. So, the clerk came with the cards. Hank said, ain't there any more? No. We took them over to the desk and we counted them, and there were 12. And 10 of them were from doctors, obviously stewed themselves, who lambasted the hell out of us, and we had exactly 2 orders for the book Alcoholics Anonymous.
Bill, this is such an incredible story of disappointment. I can't imagine how that must have felt. Can you sum that up for us?
For us, almost more than any other society, pain has been the touchstone of our spiritual progress. So we can say, thank God that we have suffered such pain, that such a spectacle as this has been brought into view and being.
Thank you, Bill. Bill. Hey, bye, Bill. Hey, say hello to Dr. Bob for us, will you? Thank you. Well, Bill's left, so I'm going to finish the story up just a little bit here. There's the big red, the first edition, first printing. Check out that jacket that came out. Can you imagine this big book? With that, they call it the circus jacket, and you're an anonymous member of Alcoholics Anonymous walking down the street with that. This is another copy for the big book. They were going to call it Pathway to a Cure. And this is an inscription that was written in Bill's book, the very first book off the press. I'll read it to you. It says, this was the very first AA book off the press. We used thick paper to make the alcoholic feel they were getting their money's worth. Bill, now I got to ask you, have you gotten your money's worth out of that book? This is a beautiful inscription to Lois, one whose loving care and fortitude in our dark days together made these pages possible. So to her, this first book of the first edition is lovingly and thankfully given Bill in memory of the fifth Christmas in his sobriety, 12/25/39. There's one more beautiful story in the writing of the big book, and it has to do with a man by the name of Bert Taylor. He had a tailoring shop on Fifth Avenue. And with all this disappointment, they had reached the end of the rope, and there was a magazine article that was going to come out. The Liberty Magazine, Morris Markey, was going to write an article, but we were so broke, we couldn't make it to that article. So they went to Bert, and they asked Bert if he could loan him some money. And Bert could not, so he called up a friend of his, Mr. Cochran, who was a benefactor, and he said to Mr. Cochran, we have this book, and we'd like to give it to you for $1 off, and we'd like you to buy it and put it in libraries. Mr. Cochran was interested, but he asked us if we'd send us our financial records and books, which we did. And he looked that over and he said, I don't think so. And so Bert said, well, Mr. Cochran, would you lend me the money? And Bert hawked his business to get us to that magazine article. The Liberty Magazine would come out September 30th of 1939. It would be called Alcoholics and God. And, I mean, it's really interesting because I have a magazine, Liberty Magazine, 1 year to the day before that, and it says why Akron is a ghost city. And I love to show you both the magazines when you come into the archives because out of the darkest times in our country's history, which our co-founders thought was providential, will come a light. And the birth of Alcoholics Anonymous. We'll have 800 inquiries will come in as a result of that. We are not out of the woods. We still have big books sitting in warehouses. And in February of 1940, Mr. Rockefeller has been watching us. We didn't know that. And he wants to throw a dinner for us and introduce us to his friends. And he's going to send out an invitation list, which is pretty darn impressive, to all the bankers and folks with a lot of money. And Fosdick will be there, Kennedy will be there, Bill Wilson will be there. All these bankers are going to be there. Morgan Ryan, that good-looking Irishman's going to be there. Nelson will preside over the dinner because his father is sick. Now, they put an alcoholic at every table. And they were all dressed up pretty nice. So was Morgan, sitting at a table. And one of the bankers looked over at Morgan and said, "And what institution are you with?" And he said, "Well, I'm not really with any institution, but I just got out of one not too long ago." They thought they were going to get money again, and that's what they wanted. And Nelson speaks for his father, and he said, "My father feels this is a work of goodwill, and money will ruin this thing." And with that, Bill says a couple $1 billion got up and walked out the door. But Mr. Rockefeller, who certainly promoted us by allowing us to use his name like we did, bought 400 of those beautiful red books for a dollar. That's probably as lowest as they ever went. And he wrote a pamphlet of all the proceedings, and he wrote a personal letter, and he signed that letter and sent it out. We're not out of the woods until Jack Alexander gets a tip, and he's going to write an article on us, and he's just finished writing an article on rackets. He thinks we're a racket. And he's coming to Akron to bust us. I think he also goes to a Chicago and a few other places. But he turns that thing around, and he wrote an absolutely beautiful article in the Saturday Evening Post, March of 1941. And this is what really helps us, because we'll get about 6,000 inquiries from that. We're going to pay Rockefeller back, and those are the checks. We've got our little office now, and I've told you kind of a hard story. I can't imagine when I tell this story or when I first learned about this story, I kind of thought of some dark times that I've had. I can't imagine during this time how Bill hung in there, how Bill and Lois actually hung in there through all that disappointment. And I think about what it is like today. What it is like today with all those big books being published and sent all over the world. And it reminds me to just hang in there, that you might just, you know, don't stop short of that miracle. And here's the two of them sitting there, kind of overlooking the publication of these. And you know, it's just another loving picture of the couple, and I just can't imagine what they must be thinking after being homeless, 52 different homes in all that time, and all the sacrifices that they made. And Bill tells us it transcended the mountain and the sea, and is even at this moment lighting candles in dark caverns and on distant beaches. And now I'd like to have you just pause for a moment and think about this story, and think about all the different people that played a part in getting us to this moment today. And if you remove one name from the list that's going to come up here, I don't know that we'd be here today. Bill Wilson, Lois, Jack Alexander, Mr. Cochran, Jim B., Henrietta Seiberling, T. Henry and Clarice Williams, John D. Rockefeller, Frank Amos, Albert Scott, Willard Richardson, Leonard Strong, Dr. Bob, Ann Smith, Dr. Silkworth, Ruth Hawk, Hank P., and may all the credit go to a higher power. Thank you.